Appearing, the next matter on our calendar this morning is the welfare of the children of LK and AS. We are here on April 23 in a Zoom panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Just so we're clear on the rules, first let me just cover the requirement that each of you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we are keeping an audio recording of the proceedings, not a video recording, even though we can see each other now. If there's any technological issues along the way, if you have difficulty hearing anyone from the court or another party, if you could somehow flag it, get our attention, and we can pause the proceedings until we get the technology under control. We appreciate that. As I understand it, we will have 15 minutes of argument for the appellant's counsel. Ordinarily, we would have 15 minutes for the respondent, but as I understand it, we're going to have an additional 5 minutes to respondent's counsel, so there's a total of 20 minutes of argument. As I understand it, the guardian ad litem will argue and split the time 50-50 with the Red Lake Nation. Am I correct about that? With an additional 5 minutes to the attorney general, is that an accurate division of the time or not?
That is accurate, Your Honor.
All right. And so we will please keep, we'll try to keep accurate time in the clock. If you have your settings set on, I think it's gallery view, you should be able to see the clock on your screen. Be mindful of those timing restrictions as you commence each leg of your argument and as you proceed. With that, unless there are any questions, we are ready to go on with our oral argument. And who'll be, so we'll hear first from the appellant's counsel for your 15 minutes of argument. Whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. My name is Rachel Osband. I'm representing the appellants, the former foster parents in this matter, Nathan and Kelly Rayltz. We are here today because it's our position that the district court committed multiple errors in its October 31st, 2023 order. And those errors resulted in prejudicial decisions and actions that were to the detriment of appellants, the children in this matter, and the birth mother in this matter. The court erred as a matter of law when it denied appellant's petition for third-party custody under 257C. It abused its discretion.
Just so we're clear, you're representing the foster parents, not the birth mother? Or are you also representing?
I'm representing foster parents, yes.
All right.
The court also abused its discretion when it denied our motion for permissive intervention by improperly applying the law regarding permissive interventions as set forth under Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 34.02 and interpreted by this court in MLS. Finally, it's our position that the court erred as a matter of law in its piecemeal application of ICWA and MIFPA in a way that disregarded the entire purpose of ICWA, as well as the good cause exceptions to ICWA, and just systematically ignoring mother and mother's wishes throughout this process, as is required under ICWA.
Ms. Osband, if I yes? could at the outset ask you, as between the first two arguments that you've made, is there a practical difference between them in terms of the benefit to your client or what relief they may seek? If we were to grant relief on one or both of those issues, is there a difference between them in the practical sense?
I do think there's a difference between them in a practical sense, in that intervention allows them to become a party to the proceedings for the entirety of the proceedings. So that would allow them to bring motions, that would allow them to engage in cross-examination, presentation of evidence, to be full parties to the proceedings, as well as potentially bring, you know, their own petition for permanency. In terms of allowing the third party petition to move forward, I believe that that's important from an area of clarification under the law, that it's well set out that third party custody petitions filed under 257C can be heard in juvenile court, and in fact, in some cases must be heard in juvenile court, as was found in Stern v. Stern. And that would allow our clients to proceed on that permanency proceeding without being parties to the matter. So I do believe that procedurally, it puts them in different places. They'd effectively be parties to the third party custody petition, but not parties to the entirety of the child protection action in the latter scenario.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, there are a lot of issues that have been raised and we don't really have a lot of time. So I'd like to jump into the second issue of 257C in terms of definitions. And under subdivision 2, it defines what a de facto custodian is. Would you agree that the foster parents qualify as de facto custodians?
I would not agree that they identify that they are de facto custodians. I would say that they are interested third parties.
Well, de facto custodians is defined as an individual who has been the primary caretaker for a child who has, within the 24 months immediately preceding the filing of the petition, resided with the individual without a parent present and with a lack of demonstrated consistent participation by a parent. So the children had been residing with the foster parents within the 24 months immediately preceding the filing of the petition, correct?
They had, Your Honor. And I think that it is up to some level of statutory interpretation to determine whether the 260C prohibition affects the time that the children were in placement. It's our position that the prohibition against bringing a third-party custody action under 257C when the children are currently placed, does exist. So you can't file a 257C petition when the children are currently placed with you for foster care. So I do think it becomes a matter of statutory interpretation whether that time period can then be used at a later date when the children are no longer placed with you.
Well, that's a separate issue from the question of whether or not they qualify as de facto custodians.
I understand that, but in terms of determining what time qualifies them as de facto custodians, I think
you're getting ahead of what I want to figure out as to whether or not they qualify as de facto custodians.
Then I would say yes, they do under just the timeline and the fact that they did have the children in their care for 6 months or more for children under the age of 3 without the consistent participation of a parent.
Okay. So, and that's helpful because if they do qualify as de facto custodians under subdivision 2D, it says de facto custodian does not include an individual who has a child placed in the individual's care. And then under subdivision 3, interested third party, subdivision 3A, it specifically says that interested third party means an individual who is not a de facto custodian. So either you are a de facto custodian or an interested third party. You can't be both. And the subdivision 2D language of de facto custodian does not include, quote, an individual who has a child placed in the individual's care, is exact language under subdivision 3B, which says that an interested third party does not include, quote, an individual who has a child placed in the individual's care. So if the foster parents qualify as a de facto custodian, by the plain language of the statute, subdivisions 2 and 3, they cannot be an interested third party then, correct?
I think that they can't be both a de facto custodian and an interested third party under that plain reading of the statute. But I do believe that if a court were to say, well, we can't qualify you for this time period that you had the children out of your care, we still can qualify you as an interested third party. So I agree that you cannot be both, but I do think that if you don't qualify as de facto, there are still circumstances that can say, but you are an interested third party here.
And I would agree with your assessment that if you don't qualify as a de facto custodian, you could potentially qualify as an interested third party, but as you acknowledge, it appears that they do fit the de facto custodian definition, which means they cannot be an interested third party.
But they would still have the right to then bring a third party custody petition in juvenile court.
Well, that's a separate issue, but they couldn't petition as an interested third party then.
Not if they met the timeline of a de facto custodian.
Ms. Ozpan, I'd like to ask a question about the first good cause exception that you were arguing for about the preference of one of the child's parents. Am I correct that under both federal and state law, a court may trigger that exception if the parent attests, if the parent attests that they have reviewed the placement options and so on. And so does that require some sort of affidavit or testimony of the parent? In this case, the district court said that it did not receive the parent's preference directly. And I'm wondering if that language in federal and state law supports that reasoning by the district court.
Well, Your Honor, just to clarify, the court did receive the information directly from the birth parent. She put it on the record at the October 5th hearing, and she submitted an affidavit stating this precisely.
But that was after the district court had denied the motion to stay the placement change, right? I mean, the district court's September 15 ruling that we're reviewing, at that point in time, the birth mother had not filed an affidavit. Am I correct?
She hadn't filed an affidavit by that point. She had spoken with both the county workers and the guardian ad litem about her choice, but the order itself that came out on October 31st, wherein the court made those statements, was actually made after mother had provided that information. And when the court determined that it was going to deny the intervention, which the mother had stated in her affidavit that she supported, and that was going to deny the third party custody petition, which mother had stated she supported, and that there was no good cause to deviate.
I don't recall that the district court reconsidered its good cause determinations in the second order. Am I wrong about that? And was it asked to do so, to reconsider the good cause exceptions?
Well, the second order was the permanent order, and the first order was the emergency order that was denied. And I can pull up the actual order here if the court just gives me 1 second.
Well, yeah, maybe that's not necessary.
I would say that we are appealing the October 31st order, wherein the court still continues to dismiss mother's position that was on the record. Now, in terms of what is required, I believe that it's required under ICWA and MIPPA that a consent be put in person in front of the court, all of that. When you're actually doing the consent to the third party custody, we did not reach that point, obviously, but it was certainly on the record in our affidavit about communications with birth mother and county workers together, where birth mother repeatedly stated this is not what she wanted. And then again, she showed up at the hearing on October 5th and submitted her own affidavit in support of that.
I have another question about sort of the interrelationship between your different arguments. If we were to deny you appellate relief on both your first and your second arguments, then would we be required to reach the third argument? The third argument is a challenge to the good cause exceptions. If we affirm the district court's decision that you can't intervene, and if we affirm the district court's decision that your third party custody petition is dismissed, then must we consider your challenge to the good cause exceptions?
Well, I would argue yes, because we still have a question of, you know, appealing the decision on the interim placement and the fact that it was not properly done under ICWA and MIFBA and the good cause exceptions, much less what the Attorney General's office itself wrote as protecting and preserving families. you know.
But if we were just, you know, carrying forward that hypothetical, if we were to agree with the district court that it did not abuse its discretion on the motion for permissive intervention, issue one, and if we were to agree with the district court that the foster parents are not an interested party, why would we need to address issues three or four then?
Because I still think that it is within this court's jurisdiction and the rights of these children under ICWA and MIFPA to say, are we complying with the law here? Is this properly done? You know, the injury in fact is the removal of these children. And, you know, mother herself put in a responsive pleading. And I know there's been discussions about whether the court can review that, but I don't think that you can say we want to apply ICWA this way to help us, but we don't want to actually look at what all of ICWA says and the fact that we're supposed to place, you know, as close to the home as possible, have access, allow the parent to have opportunities to reunify.
Well, you know, to that point, counsel, so it sounds like you're getting to the permissive intervention. And as we previously discussed, the standard of review there is abuse of discretion, whether the district court abuses discretion. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the best interest, looking at that, we start with the best interest of an Indian child, which means compliance with ICWA and MIFLA to preserve and maintain an Indian child's family. Here, the district court looked at the fact that the children are indeed protected by ICWA and MIFPA, that the Red Lake Nation approved placement with the relative has custody of the twins' older sibling, and that the twins have transitioned well into the relative's home, and that they, you know, are willing to, you know, take care of them in terms of their medical and physical, emotional needs. Why isn't that sufficient of a record? Even if we were to disagree with the district court on our own, our standard of review is abuse of discretion. Why doesn't that support the district court's determination on the motion for denying the motion for intervention?
Because we still have to look at the application of the law. And ICWA says those things, but it also says a child must be placed in the least restrictive setting, which most approximates a family, and in which his special needs, if any, may be met, will be placed within reasonable proximity to his or her home, taking into account any special needs of the child. That was not looked at. There's no finding of active efforts. There's no discussion of active efforts. There's no discussion of a QEW, which is required for third-party custody. And there's no recognition of the fact that mother has specifically said, I don't have access on Red Lake. I cannot see my child in Red Lake. I'm going to lose all contact and I can't work my plan in Red Lake. So I think if you're going to look at ICWA, you got to look at all of ICWA. And all of those things were not addressed in any substantial format by the court.
Thank you. Although your time has expired, I'm going to indulge with one 30,000 foot view question that I don't see addressed in the arguments of counsel. And that regards your challenge to ICWA on equal protection grounds. And it's just my question is, when I look at the Bracken decision and the other decisions that made their way to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, I saw that they were generally all based on challenges by states to the federal statute. I'm wondering whether you believe this court has the authority to render unconstitutional a federal law. And if so, what would be the basis of that authority?
Well, I think that this court always has the basis to determine the constitutionality of a law, which is why the Attorney General's office is here and why.
Well, I understand why the Attorney General's office would be here because, you know, there's a Minnesota statute at play. I'm just wondering what authority a state court would ever have to determine the that a 14th Amendment equal protection violation would cause the state court to invalidate a federal act.
Well, in Tischendorf, the court found that constitutional issues were raised and were sufficient to justify consideration of constitutional questions. This court considers constitutional questions all the time. Federal and state law questions, particularly with ICWA and MIFPA, are interwoven in a way that we can't pull apart.
I understand that, but you're
and
asking
in Rakeen,
you're asking us to render unconstitutional a provision of a federal law, and I'm just wondering whether there is a case that you have to support that authority in state court.
Well, I would note Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence in Rakeen, where he invited a state court challenge to ICWA as the more proper avenue for looking at a direct equal protection clause challenge to ICWA because of the fact that it comes out of state law issues, right? It comes out of family law issues. It comes out of family court. So I would point the court to Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence in Rakeen.
Thank you very much.
Judge Ross, I ask one more question of appellant's counsel?
Yeah, certainly.
This is fun. I don't have anyone to share this with.
I have another question about the interrelationship between your arguments. So your third argument is challenging the denial of good cause exceptions. If we were to grant relief to you on that argument, then would it be necessary to consider your fourth argument, which is the constitutional challenge?
I'm sorry, can...
I guess if the court were to agree with you in whole or in part on your third argument, challenging the denial of good cause exceptions, would it be necessary or appropriate for the panel to proceed to consider your fourth argument, which is the constitutional challenges to the federal and state statutes?
I think it's appropriate, but I also think that they are not inextricably linked. I think that the court can address the issue of good cause and whether the law was appropriately followed, separately and distinct from its decision on whether to undertake the constitutionality question. Obviously, if it were found unconstitutional, then that would render the second one moot. But I don't think the reverse is true.
Well, I guess maybe the point of my question is if we were to grant you relief under the statute, then are you aggrieved in any way such that you would need a constitutional challenge to the statute?
Well, I believe that the constitutional challenge to the statute has already been made. And if that were to be upheld, then I would say that our grievance is moot on the application of the law. I'm sorry if I'm not answering your question. I'm trying to sort it out in my head. But I do believe that they are still distinct questions that need to be looked at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from the respondents. And just so I'm clear, will we begin with the 10-minute argument from the guardian ad litem, or the five-minute argument's going to proceed?
Your Honor, we'll begin with the 10-minute argument from the guardian ad litem.
Thank you. You have the floor whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jody Al-Helena. I'm a staff attorney for the Minnesota Guardian Ad Litem Program, and I represent Respondent Mackenzie Borth, the Minor Children's Court-appointed Guardian Ad Litem. I will be addressing three legal issues. Your Honor, I will not be addressing the fourth constitutional arguments. This case is about two American Indian children and their rights to the protections promised them by the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, and by the state of Minnesota's CHIP statutes. It's about their right to be placed in a foster home with their sibling, within their extended family, in their tribal community, with the ability to grow up with a strong understanding of their identity, where they come from, and who they are as Indian children and Indian people. The guardian ad litem is respectfully asking this court to affirm the district court's decision in all respects, because the district court did not err as a matter of law when it denied appellant's motion to intervene, a permissive motion. It did not err as a matter of law when it dismissed appellant's third-party custody petition under 257C, and it did not err when it declined to deviate from ICWA and MIFPA's placement preferences. I will start, Your Honors, with the issue of permissive intervention. And essentially, I think it's important to note and point out that there is no common law right, there's no constitutional right, there's no statutory right for foster parents to intervene in juvenile courtship proceedings. The only right that appellants had to intervene in this underlying CHIPS proceeding was a permissive ability under the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure 34.02, which essentially states that any person may permissively be permitted to intervene as a party if the court finds that intervention is in the child's best interest. The district court in this case, Your Honors, denied appellant's permissive motion to intervene, finding that it was not in the best interest of these Indian children.
Do you believe that the district court properly approached the issue as to the liberality that is generally afforded to parties intending or seeking to participate, third parties?
Well, Your Honor, that liberality is constrained by the children's best interests. And I think even the cases that discuss that liberality discuss it in the terms of the condition being that it's in the children's best interests. Additionally, Your Honor, I think that appellants mistakenly kind of overbroaden this court's decision in the MLS case. Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure, and specifically the rule governing appeals, that would be Rule 23.02 Subdivision 1, still requires that for an order to be appealable, that the aggrieved party, it must be a final order, and then the person aggrieved by that order, it must affect a substantial right of that person. In the MLS case, Your Honor, that was a situation of a relative who did have a substantial right. So under Minnesota law, under 260C, relatives have a right to file or to request adoptive placement. So a little bit differently situated than this case, because this case before the court was a CHIPS proceeding, not a permanency proceeding. But in the MLS case, it was a permanency or post-permanency proceeding where there had already been a termination of parental rights.
Aside from the procedural issue you're raising, I'm given the district court's analysis of what constituted the basis for the best interest determination, I'm trying to imagine whether there would ever be a case where we get to that second stage where the court is directed to liberally apply the rules to allow for permissive intervention if you have an Indian case where the children are Native Americans and the tribe steps in and says what the tribe said in this case. Give me an example of where there would ever be a best interest determination going the other direction, where you'd ever get to that question of liberality.
Well, Your Honor, I think because these are so fact specific, you'd have to look at the fact, and at this point in time, I can't think of a situation where if the tribe opposed it and the tribe set forth the reasons for opposing it, that the court.
Yeah, well, that's my concern. I'm wondering if it would ever be the case. And if it's never the case, I'm not sure if that's a proper application of the permissive intervention rule.
Well, Your Honor, the best interest of an Indian child is multifaceted, right? It's intertwined, interwoven with the best interest of the child's tribe. But that's not the exclusive and only consideration. That's not the only factor in determining what's in the child's best interest. So both ICWA and MIFPA discuss that the child's best interest is preservation of their family, preservation of their rights, as an Indian child, the right to know who they are as an Indian person. And so I think that there would be situations, Your Honor, where even if a tribe objected, that there would be separate best interests specific to that Indian child that would essentially supersede or override the tribe's objection. We don't have that situation here. I'm not thinking of one off the top of my head, but I do believe that it could exist.
In the MLS case, I understand the type of proceeding and the facts are different, but the court was interpreting the same rule, 3402, I think it is. And the MLS court reasoned that the district court abused its discretion by focusing on the issue of placement, not focusing on the participation of the party seeking intervention. It seems to me that the district court in this case did something very similar to that. Would you agree or disagree?
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. And if the court were to look at the district court's October 31st, 2023 order, specifically on page 3 and the findings made in paragraphs 15 through 19, the court made some very specific best interest reasons why it was denying the appellant's motion to intervene. Essentially, the district court found that the twins were placed with a relative and their older sister attending cultural events, and that essentially appellants were seeking to disrupt that through intervening in this case. The district court also found that the best interests of these children are interwoven with the best interests of their tribe, and that the tribe supports their current placement.
But you just said the word placement. I mean, that's my point, is that it seems like the court was focusing on the ultimate issue of placement, not focusing on the participation of the foster parents, which is what they were seeking to become parties in the case. Isn't that the same error as in MLS?
Well, Your Honor, different from the situation in MLS, paragraph number 19 of the district's court in this case specifically also addresses that allowing intervention by appellants would create an unnecessary delay in permanency and finalization of this matter. And that specifically goes to the best interests of the child. There's ample case law that discusses how moving towards permanency and finalization serves the best interests of a child. So that's very different than the MLS case.
I'd like to ask a question about the good cause exceptions, appellant's third argument. One of the exceptions that they relied on in the district court proceedings was exceptional needs of the children. Would you agree that the children's needs are, excuse me, I think the word is extraordinary. Would you agree that the children have extraordinary needs?
Your Honor, I would not agree that the children have extraordinary needs. I would agree that the children have special needs. And if this case arose immediately after the children's birth, I think that we would have a situation where the children had extraordinary needs. But if you look at the record, as early as August 23rd, 2022, so just a few months after the children were placed into foster care, the guardian ad litem submitted a report to the district court setting forth in that report that the children were thriving and that their medical needs had largely and substantially resolved to the point that she did not believe the children should continue outside of ICWA's placement preferences. I see that my time has expired. I'm happy to continue to answer if I have not yet fully responded to your question, Judge Johnson.
Judge Ross, I have one more question that I would like to ask. Did the district court address and resolve the foster parents' arguments about the second good cause exception, the extraordinary needs?
Your Honor, with regard to extraordinary needs, the burden of proof lies with appellants. And under the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, if appellants are arguing extraordinary needs as a basis to deviate from the placement preference, it requires that they also produce qualified expert witness testimony. They did not produce qualified expert witness testimony.
That's required under state statute, correct? But correct. Is it required under federal law?
It's not required under federal law specifically, although, Your Honor, Section 1921 of ICWA states that if a state law provides greater protections or a higher standard, that it's the state law that is applied. So in this situation, because MIFPA provides a higher standard, it would be MIFPA that applies as opposed to ICWA.
Wait, where is that provision of law about the higher standard?
It's under 25 USC section 1921.
So my prior question, I guess, was simply, did the district court consider that issue? And if so, where in the order? The issue of extraordinary needs, that the extraordinary needs good cause exception.
Your Honor, I don't recall that it's specifically addressed as a finding in the court's order.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Ross, if I may ask one additional question.
Yes, Judge Reyes.
Thank you. Counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question that Judge Johnson asked appellant's attorney, and that is, let's just assume for the sake of argument that we agreed with you on issues one and two, the motion for permissive intervention and the interested third parties. Do we need to address the third and or fourth issue at all?
No, Your Honor, because appellants would not be parties to this proceeding, and they would have no standing to raise issues three and four.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now we will hear from either the state or the nation. Who's going first?
I believe I was, Your Honor.
Thank you. If you'll state your name and the party you represent for the record, you have the floor, I believe, yes, for 5 minutes.
Okay. Thanks, Your Honor. My name is Joe Plummer, and I'm here on behalf of the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. And I want to state that appellants are asking this court to do something that no court has ever done, and that is strike down the Indian Child Welfare Act. In 1978, the reason why ICWA was enacted by Congress is because 4 years of field work disclosed that between 25 and 35% of all Indian children in the United States were being removed from their homes and placed outside, you know, of their tribal communities. Congress relied on its plenary authority over Indians, as well as its authority in the Constitution, specifically the Indian Commerce Clause, to enact ICWA for the stability and security of Indian children and families. The court should reject appellants' equal protection challenges. Not only do appellants lack standing to make their equal protection challenges, their position in this case rests on a flawed legal premise that completely disregards the unique status of Indians, the trust responsibilities owed by the United States to tribes, the U.S. Constitution's text itself, and centuries of legal precedent.
Do you concede the appellant's position that this court would have the authority to render unconstitutional a federal law? And if not, why not?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in order for the appellants to be able to move forward, there would need to be some sort of decision on that issue in this case. But as Ms. Al-Holina just mentioned, if the court sides, you know, against the appellants on issues one and two, you would have no need to get to issues three and four, four being the constitutionality issue. What I would also like to point out,
it sounds like you are conceding that this court would have the authority to issue an opinion rendering unconstitutional the federal statute.
It would be more of a recommendation, you know, to the Minnesota Supreme Court, where it would most likely end up, Your Honor.
And you believe the state Supreme Court has the authority to render unconstitutional federal law?
Well, I think that was the posture of the Brackeen case, you know, that it ended up appealing from the state Supreme Court, you know, to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the next route. So, and we've seen all kinds of machinations over the years in the past 46 years since ICWA was enacted. One thing I want to do mention, Your Honors, is that counsel for appellants relies on Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, you know, to have standing in this court. But as the Minnesota Supreme Court just reminded us 2 months ago in the Joan Groh case, that the Minnesota Supreme Court stated it's not bound by the standing constraints of Article 3 of United States Constitution. Instead, there needs to be two ways. Minnesota law provides for two ways to get to have standing to make these constitutional arguments. One, whether or not there was a party suffered some injury in fact, and two, whether or not the party is a beneficiary of some legislative enactment specifically granting standing. And we don't have any of either one of those in this case.
Mr. Plummer, if I could just make a correction, and maybe it will change your answer, maybe not. But as I read the Hallen and versus Bracken case, that case was in fact a case filed in federal court by the birth mother and the state of Texas. So it was a federal proceeding to challenge the constitutionality of ICWA. But I don't know if that changes your answer or not.
Well, Your Honor, the Brackeen case originated in Minnesota state courts. It was a Hennepin County case, and it was joined with several other cases, several states and individual facts in that Northern District of Texas. It wasn't a clear cut route, going through the federal court system. The Brackeen case originated in Hennepin County, Minnesota. It was a white earth child. What I wanted to mention about the Brackeen is appellants incorrectly contend that the Supreme Court in Brackeen made clear that they would have standing in this case. But contrary to appellants' assertion, the Supreme Court did not hold that the former foster parents automatically establish injury in fact if they allege discrimination in applying ICWA's placement preferences. Footnote 9 in the Brackeen decision on which appellants rely states that the majority opinion did not address all of the arguments that the foster parents suffered on the injury in fact issue. Instead, the majority opinion resolved the standing issue on a lack of redressability. In this case, appellants failed to point out footnote 9 in their of the Brackeen decision to fully inform the court about what was going on there.
Mr. Plummer, I'd like to, if Judge Ross will permit, I'd like to ask a question about one of the good cause exceptions that's in the federal regulations. You probably don't have it in front of me, but you're probably familiar with it. It's the one that talks about extraordinary physical, mental, or emotional needs of the Indian child. And then the next clause is what I'm going to ask you about, which says, such as specialized treatment services that may be unavailable in the community where families who meet the placement preferences live. Can you tell us, I guess how strictly or loosely that regulation typically is applied, and how would that specific paragraph apply in a case such as this?
Well, extraordinary means, very high special needs. These children don't fit the extraordinary category. These young twins have been placed up at Red Lake for the past 6 months with their relative, and all of their medical needs have been satisfactorily met, in the medical community that we have to deal with up north. And it's not restricted to the Indian Health Service. We have the access to the whole Sanford network. That's who we deal with. If there's anything extreme, then they end up going over to Fargo, but the Bemidji is only 30 miles away. And there's been no experience with these two children that their needs have not been met.
Okay. Of course, we're reviewing a factual record that I think was made in September of last year. And so, But I appreciate though your reference to the healthcare facilities there. But maybe I have a question more about more of a legal question in the abstract, and that is, it seems like specialized treatment services that may be unavailable in the community where the placement preferences lives. It seems like that could occur often. I mean, if most Indian reservations are in rural areas, I'm not sure if that's true, but I believe so, then that could often come into play. And then I guess the other question I'm kind of getting at is, in a case such as this, where the foster parents are, I believe, in Martin County, Do you have any indication of how this factor ultimately would be applied if and when it were considered?
Well, it seems like there could be a comparison between the healthcare facilities available in Martin County versus Red Lake, and I don't think they're really that much different, Your Honor. Like I said, you know, the Martin County is like essentially on the Iowa border. You know, it's not near anything specialized. They don't have any services.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you. Counsel for the state, I believe you are batting cleanup with our last 5 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Katrin Voss, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. My intention this morning, given the limited time and that I'm last to go, was to really focus on the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. But I do want to acknowledge off the bat that, and we did state this in our brief as well, that the Red Lake Nation had filed a motion to limit the scope of this appeal. The court deferred that to this panel, and as noted in our brief, the Attorney General has no objection to the court not hearing the constitutionals in this case if the matter is decided on other issues. You know, that's a common rule in cases like this, that if you don't have to reach the constitutional issues, you need not, and we have no objection to that. Having said that, if the court does reach the equal protection issues regarding MIFPA, there was one point that I did want to make this morning, and that is that there is a Minnesota Supreme Court case that is directly on point here. That's the Green versus Commissioner of Human Services case. And I think that really simplifies things. There's been in the brief discussion of Morton versus Mancari, and the key takeaway from Mancari that was applied in Green and applies here, which is that when it comes to the equal protection analysis, if there's a law that benefits a tribe or its members, and the law fulfills the federal trust responsibility by promoting tribal self-governance, then rational basis applies. In Mancari, that related to hiring preference. The goals there were to promote self-government and to reduce the negative effects of non-Indians making day-to-day decisions on behalf of Indians. And even though that case is factually different, the goals are very similar here with MIFPA. And we can look to the statutory language in MIFPA to see those goals. And those are goals that promote self-determination of tribes, ensuring that children maintain their connections to their tribes, and perhaps most importantly, that the tribe can carry on its existence through its children. And Your Honor, I understand the Brackeen opinion didn't reach the equal protection argument, and that concerned ICWA, not MIFPA, but Justice Kagan made a comment in oral argument in that case that I think really instructs the analysis here, which is that she couldn't imagine a statute more wrapped up in the continued flourishment of political communities. And so then turning again to Green, which is binding precedent, that's where we get this important piece of the puzzle, that state laws can also fall under that trust doctrine when they help fulfill the federal trust responsibility or when they implement federal laws. And when they do, and when they involve political distinctions as they do here that promote tribal self-governance, then courts apply rational basis. You know, that was the one, Your Honor, that's the one point I wanted to make, unless there are any additional questions.
Counsel, I just had a quick question. So the Red Lake Nation argued in its brief that the appellants lack standing to challenge the constitutionality in a CHIPS proceeding such as this one because there are non-relative and former foster parents. I was wondering if the state had a position on that issue with respect to standing to challenge it in the first instance.
Your Honor, the state did not take a position on that issue. I think it involves an analysis of facts specific to this case and to the child protection laws that didn't relate to the constitutionality of MIFPA. And so we kind of steered clear of those arguments.
Okay, thank you.
If there's nothing else, I would concede the rest of my time and ask that this court hold that MIFPA comports with the equal protection requirements in the United States Constitution if you reach that matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's very telling that
If you could remind us of your name as you commence this leg of your argument before I record it.
Thank you. Rachel Osband on behalf of appellant for rebuttal.
Thank you.
I think it's very telling that neither Ms. Al-Halina or Mr. Plummer could identify a circumstance where ICWA was at play and there would be an intervention over a tribal objection, which there's always a tribal objection to an intervention by any other party, and when the extraordinary needs of the child would be met. I think that shows us exactly the concerns here with ICWA and with ensuring that we're really looking at the individualized needs of the children.
Well, I'm not sure that their argument was that, I'm not sure we can construe their position that there is no example that they could come up with to mean that there isn't one. Furthermore, as I think they correctly point out, it's a very fact-specific situation. So, I mean, don't we just need to look at the particular facts here to determine whether or not those standards have been met?
We certainly do need to look at the facts here because obviously this is on appeal, but I do think that it's concerning if, given all of the litigation we have with cases such as this and the roles that Ms. Al-Halina and Mr. Plummer play in seeing these on a regular basis, we still can't come up with an example of when it has occurred. And I would note here that when we look at the liberality of intervention, it's precisely to provide this information on the best interests of the children. Who better to provide the court with information on the individualized special needs, extraordinary needs of the children than the people who have been tending to them? You know, we have a child here who was born medically dead and has had specialized services at Mayo continuously, therapeutic services in the home. We've had multiple guardians ad litem, multiple social workers. The only people who really know what these children's needs are on a daily basis and a long-term basis are the people who've been parenting them.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with you that on that point, respectfully, counsel, because I mean, I think this is a little bit unusual because we do have the guardian ad litem. The whole role of a guardian ad litem is to look out for the best interests of the children. Furthermore, because this is an ICWA case, we do have the red light band here expressing their interests, which are very clearly laid out in both MIFPA and ICWA. So I think it's a little overstating the case a little bit to say that there's nobody representing the best interests of the children in this case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I meant that there's, when you're looking at what are the day-to-day true best interest, right? What are the needs of these children? That is where the foster parents know best, right? The guardian ad litem, it's on record, didn't pull up the medical records of the children, hasn't met with the doctors at Mayo in the neonatal clinic where the child was seen regularly.
Well, and if I might stop you there, counsel, for just a second, it sounds like you're actually getting into the merits argument with respect to a motion to permissibly intervene versus whether a party, whether or not the district court abused its discretion by denying the foster parent's right ability to intervene in this case, which it seems like we're conflating now the procedural posture with the more substantive merits issue.
Well, Your Honor, I'm addressing it because Ms. Al-Halina talked about how it was not in the best interest of the child to have intervention in response to Judge Ross's questions about liberality. So I'm explaining why there is important information in the best interest of the child that underlies this liberality of intervention, right? And by having one party intervene, it doesn't negate the guardian ad litem's ability to share information or her duties. It doesn't negate the tribe's obligations or duties. It simply provides more information to the court to make these informed decisions, which is, I would argue, the whole basis of the liberal intervention statute and construction.
Ms. Osband, I'd like to ask about, so Ms. Al-Helena made reference to section 1921 of ICWA. This was in, I think I had mentioned or asked about the fact that the federal good cause exceptions seem to be, to me, to be less strict than the Minnesota good cause exceptions with respect to extraordinary needs. And she said that in response that section 1921 would, I think, call for the application of the stricter standard. Do you have any rebuttal to that?
I think that's accurate. However, I think that that is not an issue that is determined on intervention. And when we argued the third party custody motion, we noted that a QEW is needed for any third party petition and that we intended to produce that at trial. Just as the tribe, to our knowledge, has not produced any QEW in support of their petition that has, I think, now been filed. So it was, we did make it clear to the court that we would be presenting that information, you know, at trial on the third party custody petition. It's not required in the petition itself. It's required to make the determination.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for your thorough and careful briefing in this matter and for your oral argument today. All of you represented very well your clients. They should be very happy with their representation. You've certainly helped the court in framing the issues. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. We've taken the matter under advisement now, and you should expect our decision forthcoming. Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thanks very much.